Mike Rabinovich here, founder and president of PublicSpeakingUniversity.com and our companion site, OccasionAwards.com. I want to welcome you to another session in our series of interviews with some of the world's greatest public speakers. In these sessions, I ask my guests to share with us their thoughts on the art of public speaking in general and the importance of these skills in the ministry and religious organizations in particular. Today, I have the distinct pleasure of having with me one of the leading lights in the area, Mark Sanborn. Because of his ability to educate and entertain simultaneously, he's known internationally as the high-content speaker who motivates. Mark is the president of Sanborn Associates, Inc., an ideal app for leadership development. In addition to his experience leading at the local and national level, he has written or co-authored 7 books, and he's the author of more than 20 videos and numerous audio training programs on leadership, change, teamwork, and customer service. He has presented over 2,000 speeches and seminars in every state and 10 foreign countries. Mark is a member of the prestigious Speakers Roundtable, 20 of the top speakers in the world today. He holds the Certified Speaking Professional designation from the National Speaker Association and is a member of the exclusive Speaker Hall of Fame. Mark's book, The Fred Factor, How Passion in Your Work and Life Can Turn the Ordinary into the Extraordinary, is an international bestseller and was number 6 for 2004 on Business Week's bestseller list. His latest book is You Don't Need a Title to Be a Leader, How Anyone, Anytime Can Make a Positive Difference. Mark is a past president of the National Speaker Association. His clients include Costco, Enterprise Rent-A-Car, Exxon, Harley-Davidson, Hewlett-Packard, Mortons of Chicago, New York Life, Service Master, Washington Mutual, Wells Fargo, and others. He and his wife, Darla, and sons Hunter and Jackson live in Highlands Ranch, Colorado, and are members of Cherry Hills Community Church. Welcome, Mark.
Michael, thank you. It is my pleasure to be with you today.
For our listeners who have not had the pleasure of reading your books or attending one of your events, can you tell us a little bit about your company and how it all got started?
I started speaking at the age of 10 in competition. I grew up on a farm in northeast Ohio and was a member of 4-H, a youth organization. They needed someone to represent our 4-H club at the speaking competition. I volunteered and really thought, hey, how hard could it be? Well, I found out it was very hard, and I did very poorly. And as a result of that initial tremendous failure I had at public speaking, it really challenged me to learn how to speak. And I really think to this day, if I hadn't had such a tough experience early on, I might have never tried again. But I did try again, and I kept entering contests. And over the years, because of my young age, I was asked to speak to civic organizations and even in churches. So I spent a great deal of my early speaking experience doing 10 and 15 minute sermonettes, not really what you would call theologically heavy, but I did get a lot of experience speaking in both a secular and a religious environment. And then after serving as both the state and national president of the Future Farmers of America, I was able to work my way through college as an after-dinner speaker. A lot of people had heard me speak in that leadership capacity and invited me to come back and address their graduating class or their organization. And the spirit of free enterprise set in, and I started charging at the time $100, $150, $200 for a speech. And that's how I was able to work my way through college. After about 6 to 7 years in the sales and marketing arena, I started speaking full-time. That was about 21 years ago. And today, my primary livelihood is in writing books and speaking about leadership, service strategy, and the keys to both organizational and personal success.
From that first experience when you were 10, what steps did you take better at it? Because, at that age, you probably don't really know how to go about it. Is it a function of simply doing it over and over again, or did you take some specific steps as you look back now that help you become a better public speaker?
Michael, I think the answer is yes. It was about doing it over and over again. However, it was also about taking advantage of resources that were available to help me learn how to be a better speaker. You know, if you practice the wrong thing over and over, you'll just reinforce the wrong behavior. So I think it's very important, and for anyone who is listening who has been speaking in as part of their leadership or part of their ministry, their responsibilities, if you're not getting better over time, it's because you're doing the same things over and over and not learning new skills or trying new ideas. So I really searched out what I thought at the time were the best speakers, people like Zig Ziglar back then and Dennis Waitley and Og Mandino, and I both read their materials and studied how they spoke. I really became then, and am to this day, a student of speaking. I think that if you are really committed to getting better at whatever you do, you try to learn from the best, and frankly, you can learn from the worst. I've certainly learned what not to do over the years by watching people who weren't as effective or weren't as successful at speaking.
When we work with our visitors to our site and our customers, we divide public speaking into three areas, one of which is the content, which is what it is that you're going to say. Secondly is the skills required to do so effectively. And thirdly is the fear. And, you know, different research over the years has told us that 9 to 10 people that you see outside your window today have a fear of public speaking, and most of them would rather be in a dentist chair than speaking even in front of a small group of people. As growing up and honing your skills, how did you deal with the fear aspect of public speaking?
Well, I'm going to give you a word that bridges all three of those areas, both the content, the skills, and the fear. It is the single most powerful tool to reducing fear, and I don't think you can completely eliminate fear. I think, by the way, the goal is to move from fear to performance anxiety. Performance anxiety is controlled. Fear is uncontrolled. And if you use this metaphor of an athlete who's about to compete on the playing field is going to have a certain amount of energy that comes from that anticipation and anxiety that makes them want to perform their best. I actually think that a complete lack of anxiety suggests either overconfidence or a lack of commitment. So I do want to clarify that you want to move fear from the uncontrolled thing that sets us back to a performance anxiety that can help us perform better. Now, having said that, what reduces fear, what increases skill, and what makes content even better is simply preparation. It's been my experience that the best communicators are simply those people who are willing to spend a little more time developing their content, honing their skills, and as a result of being confident about what you're going to say and how you're going to say it, you're able to get control of fear.
I've never heard it put that way, and that's excellent, because I remember when I started practicing law, I mean, I just simply prepared my arguments and read them over and over again. And you're right, I never completely got over the fear, but I was able to manage it. and I think that's a great distinction, and I think it's certainly going to be useful to our listeners. As your public speaking skills got better and better, what impact did it have on both your personal and business lives?
I think that effective public speaking is probably the greatest leverage to any profession, career, or especially to leadership. Because good ideas communicated well are far more powerful. And it's really a tragedy, in my opinion, that there are teachers and pastors and rabbis and priests who have wonderful content, but who never get that content taken seriously or listened to or thoroughly considered because they lack skill in delivering it. Now, what really scares me, Michael, is that we live in an age where a good communicator can foist just intellectual silliness on people and make it believable if they have good communication skills. So I think it's incumbent on a responsible communicator and a responsible leader to make sure that when they have good ideas and they have good content, that they communicate it well, because the greatest enemy right now, or the greatest challenge that a communicator has, is a lack of attention. The average person is bombarded with a great deal of distraction from the media, from their personal lives, their professional lives. And so when you have someone listening to you, when they're sitting in front of you, you've got to somehow break that preoccupation they have with just about everything except what you're trying to tell them, to grab and engage their imagination so for that period of time that they're in front of you, they put aside all those other concerns and distractions and pay attention to the content of your message because it's delivered well.
This was a great segue into my next topic that I want to cover, and this is public speaking in the context of the ministry and religious organizations. On one of our sites, occasionalwords.com, we give away public speaking tips for ministers, and we're about to offer an e-book and a teleseminar on the same subject. And in the time we've been offering it, we've noticed a lot of interest. In your view, as a speaker and as someone who also attends church regularly and participates in a regular Bible study group, what is the role of effective public speaking in the ministry and religious organizations?
Well, I think the role of effective public speaking in ministry and in any religious context is, number one, to get people interested in an important area or arena of their lives that they have a critical need in but might be unaware of. You know, we say in selling that a good salesperson is able to leverage a need into awareness. And I happen to believe, as a person of faith, that we all have a spiritual vacuum created inside of us by our Creator that we often try to fill with different and often inappropriate things. So I think the first job of a religious communicator is to, in a way that is inviting rather than off-putting, is to invite people into a space where they understand that there is a very important spiritual dimension to our lives and that we need to pay attention to it and to deal with it. Then I think the next step is to simplify the complex, not to make it simplistic. Something that is simplistic is too simplified, but rather to take the great theological and philosophical truths that a communicator holds to be important and to communicate them in such a way that they are both interesting and compelling. And I think that that ability to take what many people think is just way above and beyond them, you know, questions of theology, questions of how to live, ethics, morality, and to make them accessible. And in my books, I write short books, and I've written long books, but far more people read my shorter books because I think my goal in those shorter books is to take a big subject like leadership and to make it truly accessible for people. And finally, I think that a good communicator is able to transfer the passion and enthusiasm they have for their topic to the listener. When I was in college, back when dinosaurs roamed the earth at Ohio State University, I attended college one summer to kind of make up for some lost time. And one of my electives was a course on astronomy. And to be totally honest, I took the course because it was a lot less challenging, I thought, than some of the other options I had. I really didn't have a big interest in astronomy, but for that period of time, because of the passion and enthusiasm and skill of my professor, I really became engaged with astronomy. He was able to kind of transfer to me some aspects of astronomy that made it interesting to a guy who really didn't have any interest previous to that. And I've always thought back on that experience and been reminded that there are really no hot topics, but that a speaker makes a topic hot, makes a topic interesting, regardless what that topic might be. And so I think that's ultimately our challenge as communicators.
You speak often of leadership, obviously, and this is what you teach a lot. And what is the connection between effective public speaking skills and strong leadership? And I refer specifically here to the ministry context, where ministers basically have to be in the public speaking mode pretty much their entire working lives, communicating with their congregations, staffs, and the community at large.
Well, a pastor is, to use a secular term, the front person for their congregation or for their congregants. And so it's vitally important because, like it or not, right or wrong, I mean, we live in an imperfect world, the perception that people will have of that particular religious organization will be formed first and foremost by the speaking ability of the leader of that congregation, that temple, that synagogue. And so I think it's incumbent upon that communicator to realize that how he or she communicates really paints a picture of the organization and the people that attend there. Now, as people get to know others, as they become engaged in different aspects of the group, that perception may change. But, you know, it's important to realize that much as a singer fronts a band, a pastor or a rabbi fronts their congregation. And so they owe it not just to themselves and not just to the principles that they believe, but to their congregation to communicate powerfully and accurately what that group stands for, what they believe in, and what they're about.
And how do you view that also internally in terms of getting young people to attend church or synagogue, getting them to stay involved from the time they're kids all the way through to the time they have their own families?
Well, it's very difficult as a communicator, a public speaker, to encompass all of the different generations that one has in front of them at any given time. And I think that if there's an important nuance that we could all benefit from learning more about, it would be some of the different styles and likes and dislikes of different generations when we communicate to them. For instance, today, Generation X and Generation Y were raised on MTV. And that means that in a typical one-minute music video, there might be up to 120 or 130 different image changes. It's a very visual culture that we live in. And that doesn't necessarily mean, as some of my colleagues would tell you, that we have to be visual and use PowerPoint and or use movie clips, although I think both of those things done well does add to the power of the message. But what it means is that we need to, at the very least, paint very rich word pictures and be very imagery-oriented in how we communicate. Because just giving people facts and figures and doctrine will be very off-putting to most listeners, all listeners really, but especially to younger listeners. And that really brings me to what I think is the key to all great speaking and all great communication, and that's the power of the story.
Mm. You would advise ministers or pastors to really engage more in storytelling as opposed to just look at a sermon as simply teaching a particular lesson.
Oh, unequivocally. You know, I teach a technique called PIP. It's an acronym, P-I-P, and it stands for Premise, Illustration, and Point. And it's very useful both in constructing and delivering a message. You begin with a premise. The premise is in your head. The premise answers the question, what is it I want my listener to think, feel, or do? In other words, it answers the question, what am I trying to accomplish here? Because all good communication, all good speaking is very purposeful. Once you have that premise, the next question is, what's a powerful illustration that I can use to help move people towards that thought, that emotion, that action? You'll sometimes hear people suggest that we should tell people the point and then tell a story. I disagree with that because once people hear a point, they often stop listening to the story. It's kind of like if you know how the book ends, why bother to read the book? What I suggest we do is that we tell that story or we use that illustration because sometimes it's not just a story. It might be an illustration from contemporary events. We use that illustration at the end. We then focus people on what the point was. You know, you say, you know, what can we learn from this story? Well, there are many things, but what I really want you to focus on today is this. So premise is, what do I want them to think, feel, or do as a result of the illustration? We then pick the illustration, communicate it, and make sure that the audience or the listener knows what the point is, and we can bring them back to that point so that we effectively direct their thinking and attention.
So the illustration is what you use to make the lesson come to life.
Oh, exactly. And you know, what makes a story powerful, you know, Rob Bell in Michigan makes some interesting points about story. What makes a story powerful isn't necessarily that it's my story or your story. The best stories are always our stories. You hear a good story and you go, oh, you know what? I had something like that happen. I've seen that happen. I know someone like that. Or I'm a little bit like that myself. And the other thing that's really important to understand about stories, especially as they relate to the Bible, is that what makes a story from the Bible powerful isn't just that it happened, but that it continues to happen. The great stories of the Bible continue to play themselves out day in and day out. So it makes storytelling makes what we're communicating not just come alive, but it makes it very relevant to the present.
When we speak to pastors or to rabbis in different religious organizations, we obviously speak to the ones who are open to the importance of to having effective public speaking skills and to improving them. And we hear the story over and over again that a lot of the other pastors or rabbis that they deal with have a real resistance in terms of really acknowledging that they must have effective public speaking skills and in terms of realizing that it's a lifelong work in terms of improving them. I mean, what point would you get across to people that resist that in terms of the importance of having these effective skills and continuing to improve them throughout their careers?
Well, first, let me begin by saying that no matter how good a communicator becomes, there's always room for improvement. I've been in the business for over 21 years, and I continue to learn new things. I continue to improve. I think the most dangerous spot any professional can reach is the point where they believe they know it all. They've learned it all. They've got nothing new to learn. But I would also add that if you really are serious about being effective, and this is really the question. The question isn't, do you like speaking or do you want to be a better speaker? The question that comes ahead of that is, are you willing to do the hard work that's necessary to become effective in your role? And if speaking is part of your responsibilities, then you're in some kind of unusual denial when you say, I really don't care how well I communicate, or I'm doing well enough. And you might want to try, for the listeners who are brave enough, you might want to do an anonymous survey with your listeners after a presentation. You might simply say, give everybody an index card and say, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being terrible and 10 being terrific, how'd I do? And then ask them to write down one idea that would have made that presentation better for the listener. And you'll quickly get two things. Number one, you'll quickly get kind of a relative numerical scale of how you think you're doing compared to how your listeners think you're doing. And by the way, their evaluation counts. You know, it's kind of like when my kids come home from school. It's the teacher that filled out the report card. If my boys fill out the report card, they're going to get straight A's. But there's no credibility to that. So if you as a pastor or rabbi are saying, hey, I'm an excellent communicator, well, you might think you are, but it's your congregants that are going to give you the real credible grade. But if you ask people to write down what's one idea you can use to improve, you're going to pick up all sorts of ideas about, you know, what balance of illustrations or humor or references to biblical points or what translation of the Bible is more accessible to people to use. So that's a quick way to kind of overcome this resistance. But ultimately, you know, I happen to believe in free will, and I believe that if God gave me free will, gave me a choice about what I believed and what I did, I can't really impose on someone else their need to become a better communicator. That becomes a point of personal responsibility that will ultimately be up to them.
I mean, the reason I ask it is that, I mean, there's certain frustration on the part of bigger congregations where there's more than one rabbi or pastor, and they deliver different speeches, and they're all in it together, so to speak. And it's amazing, and I'm sure you've sat through sermons and I've sat through sermons where you just have to sit there because you've shown up and you can sit there till it ends, and other sermons where you just don't want to leave. That's part of frustration I see within the religious organizations that I've spoken to. In terms of working on this, how can minister work on continuously improving their public speaking skills in the context of what they do every single day?
Well, there are a few ideas I would suggest. The first is, I think Toastmasters International is a wonderful organization. I have been involved directly and indirectly over the years with Toastmasters. There's always at least one or two and sometimes dozens of Toastmasters clubs in a given community. And I think there's two reasons why a religious leader like a pastor or a priest or a rabbi might want to participate. The first is, it's a very non-threatening and very supportive environment that uses very basic techniques to take you from being a beginning speaker to being an accomplished speaker. And that's a chance to practice on a weekly basis, because most Toastmasters clubs meet on a weekly basis. But another benefit is if you think your message is important, it's a great networking opportunity to meet other leaders, to also connect with people who may need a religious home that don't have one. So I think there are more reasons than just becoming a better speaker to participate in Toastmasters. Number two, you can go into any religious bookstore and find some excellent books on homiletics and on public speaking. You know, some of my favorite books have been written by people like Howard Hendricks and Andy Stanley. Those are two names that come to mind. Bill Hybels has written a book or two about communicating effectively. And if you really want to know where to begin in terms of a good book you might read, ask a few friends for a recommendation, or, you know, send me an email at mark@marksanborn.com. I'll be glad to suggest a book or two that I think would be helpful, because the book has helped me. And finally, I would suggest that you do the highly unusual, old-fashioned practice of practicing. Think of an illustration that you want to perfect. Think of a point that you want to make. And in the privacy of your study or your office, spend 2 or 3 minutes talking through it. There's a difference between understanding something intellectually and being able to demonstrate or communicate it. Different part of the brain is accessed. We use a different part of the brain. And so practice, not just preparation and thought, actual practice improves our ability to deliver because it directly improves our skill set.
You mentioned a number of books on public speaking, and obviously there's a ton out there, and there's a bunch of classics as well. If you had to pick one, maybe two books that you would recommend, what would they be?
Wow, I've got a library of several thousand books. So, Michael, that's a tough question off the top of my head. I would like to offer your listeners a resource because I have a reading list at my website.
That'd be excellent.
www.marksanborn.com. I also blog regularly on leadership and communication issues at www.youdontneedatitle.com. So if any of your listeners are interested, and this is all free, I'm not selling them anything, if they would like to access my blogs on leadership and communication or access my recommended reading list, I would recommend marksanborn.com or youdontneedatitletobealeader.com. But in terms of specific books, there are many, and as soon as I recommend one, we're going to conclude our interview, and I'm going to think of six more I wish I would have recommended in addition to or instead of.
Fair enough. Now, for listeners who are committed to improving their public speaking skills on a continuous basis, what books or programs can you recommend from your website? Because I know you have a bunch of products for that.
Well, I'm kind of reevaluating. My primary work is in leadership development, and so I don't offer a great deal of recorded programs on public speaking or communicating. I do have a program. I think the principles are very valid. The program has been out for a few years, so some of the context might be a bit dated, called Speak Like a Pro. There are four audio cassette tapes, and just in saying that, that gives you an idea of how old the program is. We're probably going to convert that program and any new work we do in the area of communication to CD or DVD. But Speak Like a Pro would certainly be a resource, and there are also, again, free of charge, some great articles on public speaking at the marksanborn.com site.
And last question here, Mark. If you had one tip to give to people that are still dazed about public speaking, whether it's within the ministry or outside the ministry, have the fear, have the heart palpitations, what is the first step that they ought to take in order to address that?
Well, this might sound unusual, but I believe the first step and the most important step is to have a philosophy of speaking. You know, philosophy, as most of your listeners will well know, means a love of wisdom. And I think before we practice the what and the how, we need to understand the why. And so I'll just quickly suggest my own philosophy of public speaking, and that is, number one, I believe that we live in a world full of pain. There's a lot of terrible stuff that goes on in the personal lives of people every day. Some we learn about, much that we don't. Whenever we speak to a group of people, there are always people in the audience dealing with tough stuff. I also believe, and this is the second part of my philosophy, that we live in a world that offers an incredible opportunity for joy. You know, joy not by denying the pain, but joy right along with the pain. Joy in spite of the pain. That, you know, even though it's a fallen world, we have the opportunity to experience joy. And that really brings me to my third and important point, and that is, as a speaker, I can be of value to my audience by either helping them lessen the pain, increase the joy, or both. And I think that's what great pastors and rabbis do. Mm. I think they show us how to deal with the challenges of life. They show us how to take advantage of, recognize, and participate in the joy of life. And when they've done either or both of those things, then I think they've been a very, very effective communicator.
Well, that's a great great way to put an exclamation mark in this interview. Thanks so much for your time today, Mark. I greatly appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. All the best.